Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello and welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm your host, William Miller. My guest today is Robert E. Luckett, Jr., a history professor at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi, where he also directs the Margaret Walker Center and the COFO Civil Rights Education Center. Welcome, Robbie.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be here.
You're the author, among your other scholarly articles and carefully researched works, of a book that focuses on Joe T. Patterson, the Mississippi Attorney General from 1956 to 1969. Your book offers us a case study that opens up the life and work of a dedicated white segregationist who was at the same time challenged by the times and the forces that countered all he worked to preserve. The book title is Joe T. Patterson and the White South's Dilemma. The subtitle is Evolving Resistance to Black Advancement. What did you mean by that subtitle? Let's start there, if we might.
In the American consciousness, we generally think about the Civil Rights Movement and we think about white Southerners. We think of them as kind of a monolithic entity that has changed very little over the last, couple of centuries, but especially over the course of the 20th century. And what I was trying to get at is how that brand of segregationist conservatism and white supremacy, which is what it ultimately is, how it actually changed and became more sophisticated over time and in many ways more entrenched in our state, in American society, because ultimately I believe this story is not just a Mississippi story, it's an American one, and how those segregationists in places like Mississippi became modern-day conservatives, and how they shaped modern-day conservatism in the South and in this country.
It was a fascinating time when he was in office. There was, in his time, the Supreme Court's decision, Brown, school desegregation, integration of Ole Miss. There was the decision in New Kent County, Virginia, by the Supreme Court following up on Brown that said, you've got to force busing if necessary to have integration. There was the assassination of Medgar Evers. There was the Civil Rights Act. There was the Freedom Summer. So all this was going on. And I think we sort of, have to contextualize for listeners who may not immediately grasp what was happening. And a lot of it was there in Mississippi. So you had a very ripe subject and a very ripe time to study there. It's kind of like a crucible, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about Joe Patterson's career, he was the state attorney general from 1956 to 1969. So we're talking, when you think about the American Civil Rights Movement, the height of the movement, right? From Brown and in the context of Brown that he's running for state attorney general for the first time, all the way up through the evolution of the movement, through nonviolent direct action protests into the Black Power movement, and all of these things happening in the state of Mississippi, which made him an excellent lens to look into how segregationists were opposing the civil rights movement. And his job as attorney general was to craft the legal strategy. And I put legal in kind of quotes because ultimately it's meant to thwart the legal rights of particularly African-Americans in Mississippi. But it was his job to legally defend segregation and Jim Crow Mississippi. And so his career, his life was an excellent lens into that story and into that history. And you have a little known segregationist in Joe T. Patterson, who I think sheds a lot of light onto a larger narrative.
So let's go back and figure out who Joe Patterson was. He grew up in Mississippi.
Yes.
He, though, was not from the agrarian side of Mississippi. He lived in a town. His father was a judge. Pick us up there. What kind of life did he have?
Yeah, he lived in North Mississippi, outside of the Mississippi Delta, which after Reconstruction becomes the heart of the new Cotton Kingdom in the early 20th century. And that's, when we think about that agrarian power that you're talking about, the heart of it is in the Delta. Joe Patterson's not from that area, not from that regime of power. Instead, he has a pretty firmly kind of middle class life and upbringing in North Mississippi, in a place, when we think about the Mississippi Delta, has more African Americans as a percentage of as any place in the nation, which is why Mississippi is also the blackest state in the nation to this day. The Delta was very different, though, from the hills, even though it was fairly close. He wasn't that far from the Delta. So he grew up in a world where his life was shaped much more by kind of the white-collar existence of his father as a judge and by the sensibilities of the privilege he had growing up in Calhoun City.
I think his sister told you that they had the black woman who worked for them as their maid come to the Christmas tree for this family celebration. I don't imagine she sat down in a chair. She probably stood at the back of the circle.
That's right. And that wouldn't have been uncommon either to have black help. We all know that the famed movie that lifted up the stories of the domestic servants, especially in Mississippi. And for someone of their economic class and standing to have had a black domestic servant would have been pretty common. But of course, this notion and constructed idea of a paternalistic South, supposedly, right? Of this notion of particularly white men being benevolent to poor black folks, which was largely mythical. But there still were manifestations of it where you could see it and where white folks could point and say, hey, these are our people. We're good to them. They love us. We invite them to our Christmas party. And they might, in fact, show up. And who knows what the motives are of that person who does come, who does show up, whether it's self-preservation, preservation of family, preservation of a job and what little income. There were not very many avenues for economic advancement for black folks in the state of Mississippi, especially in the early 20th century, in this period where he's born and raised, which is the height of Jim Crow, sharecropping, cotton society in Mississippi in the early 20th century. And so it wouldn't have been, again, uncommon for them to have had a black servant who came and worked for them, or for that person to potentially show up for these types of things and for them to say, hey, see, we're good white people. We take care of our folks.
And I think you make the point in the book that you know, he might stand aside and hold the door open for a black woman and let her go before him.
That's right. And, you know, when I was interviewing the family, especially his son, Bill Patterson, actually really opened a lot of these doors for me and was super supportive. I was kind of surprised how supportive he was of my research and opening the family. He just wanted someone to really investigate this and tell this story. I don't know that he agreed with all of my interpretations, but he certainly was supportive and always has been. And so Bill introduced me to these other family members and folks to talk to. And I think there is something in human nature where we want to think of ourselves and our families, and especially our parents and those people who are most immediate to us, as often better than we were, as often better morally and as better historical actors than the past actually plays out. And so memory, human memory, is a funny thing. We want to see ourselves as doing things in a way that reflects on us better today than perhaps the light of that actual time would reveal. And so these stories of this genteel man, very polite, I have no doubt that he was, those skills played a really significant role in his capacity to help mold and shift and change segregationist conservative politics in the state of Mississippi. Because the real trick here is to say, hey, I'm not a bad guy. I'm not racist. I don't shout the N-word. I'm not here trying to, you know, promote racialized violence, lynching. I'm not doing any of these things. I'm a good guy. I'm nice. Look at me. But in reality, doing everything possible to preserve as much of that system of power as possible. And so those narratives, those stories about this, you know, nice, genteel, Southern, polite man help to obscure the work that he was really doing behind the scenes to maintain white supremacy and white supremacist power as much as possible.
I think it's important to kind of contextualize his period of service. in Mississippi, not far from where he lived, the year before he became Attorney General, there was the murder of Emmett Till, which is a fairly well-known case where Emmett Till, a young man visiting from Chicago, said something or whistled perhaps at a young white woman who was tending a corner grocery store. That was like on a Thursday, and on Saturday he was kidnapped, tortured, beaten, killed, his body weighted down and thrown into a river where it was found. 15 years later, about a year after Patterson had left office in North Carolina, there was a not dissimilar situation in a little town called Oxford, North Carolina, where a veteran of the military service went into a corner grocery, got too friendly with the white woman who ran the store, and was chased down by three white men, killed. And at the trial that summer, they had indicted two white men, and the third one confessed on the witness stand to having been the one who pulled the trigger. But the way he confessed, he couldn't then be indicted. So the jury found the two who had been indicted not guilty. This is, you know, and back to the Emmett Till case, the jury found those gentlemen, I use the term loosely, not guilty. And they later sold a confessional story to, what was it, Look magazine? And everybody said basically they just did that for the money. It's not really true or something like that.
That's right.
So that's, while we talk about gentility, I think we also need to talk about the fact that there was violence going on.
Yeah, sure. Sorry. I would just say, let us understand, the Jim Crow power structure in Mississippi was a terrorist regime. It was underscored and enforced through violence. Empirically, we know that Mississippi was the most dangerous state in the nation for African Americans, and especially for activists. We know from the Equal Justice Initiative, who has studied racial terror lynchings, that's their term for it, from 1877 to 1950, so right before Emmett Till. We know that Mississippi had the most known lynchings in racial terror lynchings per Equal Justice Initiative in American history. And known is the important word, because we know there are thousands of people who just disappeared and we don't know what happened to them. And part of that definition for the Equal Justice Initiative in a racial terror lynching is that it is a murder that people get away with. There's never any justice. And from 1877 to 1950, that what 70, almost 75 year period, Mississippi had, I believe the number 654 known lynchings, or known lynching every 6 weeks for 73 years. You think about that type of violence where we know someone was murdered, we know who was murdered, we know who murdered them, and we know they got away with it every 6 weeks for 73 years. So yes, please understand that the context of Mississippi at that time, especially by the time of Emmett Till and his murder in 1955, is one fundamentally entrenched in racist violence used to prop up the system. And by the time you get to the 1950s, there are now generations of Mississippians, white and black, who this is the only thing they've known in their past, in their history, in this world that they come into. And it's that violence and arguably the murder of Emmett Till that will spark the rumblings of change in the South. And look, I would argue we've always had a civil rights movement. I think we've always had people fighting for freedom all the way back to 1619, all the way through today. I think we've always had people who have demanded the rights of human dignity and social justice. But when we talk about the civil rights movement in America, we talk about this period of post-World War II, late 40s, 50s, and 60s, the murder of Emmett Till is a spark for both a generation of activists who were Emmett Till's age, who become the leaders of the movement in 1960 with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, the sit-in movement, the Freedom Rides, COFO, the Council of Federated Organizations in Mississippi, Freedom Summer. These young people who were the vanguard of the movement of the 1960s are Emmett Till's generation, and almost to a person, they point to his murder and death as a turning point in their life and in their lives and in their consciousness, as a moment where they realized they could be murdered for no reason other than just being black and being in Mississippi. The same thing is true for white Mississippians, because the murder of Emmett Till and the subsequent acquittal of his murderers galvanizes white folks. We often talk about the term massive resistance in Mississippi, talking about segregationists and how segregationists opposed the movement at all costs. Line in the sand, defiance of any Black advancement. And Emmett Till becomes a turning point because there are those who recognize, well, you know, one, we can't let these quote unquote outside agitators come in and tell us how to run our white supremacist power structure and state. But at the same time, we may be losing a little bit of our grip on power, because what you're finally seeing for the first time is some willingness of the federal government and Americans kind of writ large to recognize there's something wrong and there's a threat. And so while massive resistance, white folks had always been resisting Black advancement, especially post-emancipation in this kind of the modern era, and of course, before that in slavery. Emmett Till and his murder in 1955 and the Brown versus Board of Education decision, those two things kind of back to back, causes this idea of massive resistance to come back to the forefront of what people are talking about and how they're thinking about opposing the civil rights movement. And it leads to some initial fissures within the segregationist power structure and people debating, well, what is the right way to maintain Jim Crow? How do we go about maintaining as much power as possible, as much white power as possible in the state of Mississippi? And it's a real turning point. But yes, all of Jim Crow history is fundamentally rooted, especially in Mississippi, in a violent system of power where that violence was used to maintain as much power as possible. But violence as a tool is by the 50s and 60s, especially after Emmett Till, coming under increasing scrutiny.
And I cited the Oxford, North Carolina situation or case just to say Mississippi isn't alone. Mississippi is a great study point because absolutely, so much was happening, and it was a focal point in that time period, but it was not alone. And you make the point in the book that you cited the Brown case as also a kind of a catalyst, but you also make the point in the book that the whole resistance to change actually by the white supremacists goes back to the Reconstruction period when the whites redeemed their land, their territory, their governance, their system, their caste system, if you will, from the Reconstruction period.
Absolutely. And there was a moment in time during Reconstruction where this, what we talk about as counterfactual histories, what would have happened if there was a moment of time during Reconstruction where African Americans were making incredible progress in Mississippi. They were the majority of the population in the state. We had two Black U.S. senators. We had a Black U.S. congressman. We had, you know, Black-owned businesses across the state. And that was a function of having such a high population of African Americans in the state of Mississippi. And there's a much longer story there to tell. And yet there's a series of events that very quickly turns that history on its head and turns the narrative of Black advancement into a story of Black, instead of advancement, what was the story of white redeemers and white supremacists as being the victims of Black oppression, as opposed to great success of Black advancement. And this Old South narrative, the lost cause narrative of, oh, white people were really the ones who were oppressed, that not just narrative, but underpinnings of Jim Crow and the rise, the political rise of Jim Crow, which in many ways is invented in Mississippi in terms of poll taxes and literacy exams. The Mississippi Constitution of 1890 lays the blueprint for Jim Crow political power that every Southern state will copy and call the Mississippi Plan. And all of it is ultimately undergirded at that time by violence. But once they have the political power, and when we talk about Jim Crow, I think we have to talk about political power, economic power, and social power. Socially, we think about segregation. Economically, we think about sharecropping. And politically, we think about disfranchisement, just kind of broadly. But what was underlying all of that was lynching and the violence that propped it up. And this narrative of the lost cause helped to cement the righteousness, supposedly, of that regime. And that's what Joe Patterson is born into. He's born into a family and a system of power that had been benefiting from this Jim Crow Mississippi for several decades by the time that he's coming of age and becoming an adult and engaging politics himself.
Now, he got into politics, well, he started off as a city attorney.
That's right.
And then he did a stint in D.C. On the staff of a Congress, Yes. Who was a member of Congress?
He was a U.S. Senator.
U.S. Senator.
Okay. And he worked on his staff. And Pat Harrison's story is really fundamental to Joe Patterson's story, because this debate over the line in the sand defiance of demagogic racists was not really new in the 50s and 60s when Joe Patterson found him at the center of it. But it was happening in the 30s and in the 40s, and when he was on the staff of Pat Harrison. Pat Harrison defeated James K. Vardaman to win his seat in the U.S. Senate. James K. Vardaman was one of the most notorious demagogic racists in all of Mississippi history. Pat Harrison beats him by running a grassroots campaign, where he's like, I'm not that guy. I'm different. And he finds his way into the U.S. Senate and quickly becomes elevated in positions of power. One of the things very few people really talk about when we talk about the New Deal, Pat Harrison was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee during the New Deal, which means every piece of New Deal legislation had to come through his hands, had to come through his committee to be passed, which was one of the fundamental reasons when we talk about the New Deal, that New Deal policies were discriminatory, were segregated, often detrimental to African Americans. And for Pat Harrison, it was a story of, okay, we're going to control this legally. I'm not going to be out here shouting and throwing out racist epithets the way James K. Vardaman was, but I'm going to be here with real power behind the scenes and controlling this. The irony is Pat Harrison, the junior senator from Mississippi would be elected, and that would be Theodore Bilbo, one of the other incredibly racist, demagogic political face figures in Mississippi history. Theodore Bilbo was James K. Vardaman's protege. And so you have these two guys, Theodore Bilbo, the junior senator from Mississippi, also a Democrat, hates Pat Harrison. And when Pat Harrison is up to be Senate majority leader, he loses by one vote. And Theodore Bilbo cast the deciding vote against his fellow senator from the same party in the state of Mississippi. And so this divide between an incredibly powerful segregationist voice, but who used his power through these kind of legal means as chair of the Senate Finance Committee and his role within the New Deal itself, versus the James K. Vardaman, Theodore Bilbo, and eventually Ross Barnett ilk of politicians. That was where Joe Patterson gets his training, gets his perspective, and it's at the feet of this incredibly powerful man, Pat Harrison, that very few Americans know anything about in terms of American history.
So Patterson comes back. He's the Attorney General. Let's look at the James Meredith case, because sure. I think that really shows the atmosphere, but also the way that Joe Patterson got caught, if you will, between the extremes and acted like Harrison might have in the similar situation.
Absolutely. And frankly, I hope it's fairly obvious. My book turns on the Meredith story in 1962. And I think this is really, I would argue, a moment in Mississippi history where this path begins to diverge politically for white Southern segregationists and conservatives away from the demagogic power of Ross Barnett. 1962 is the turning point. And ultimately, you have Joe Patterson, who is, again, responsible for defending the state of Mississippi, responsible for erecting the legal defenses to try to keep James Meredith out at all costs out of the University of Mississippi in 1962, and who pursues that work with vigor. His focus is on keeping James Meredith out. And then he loses, and the state of Mississippi loses. And the question, the dilemma in the White South's dilemma in 1962.
When you say loses, explain what you mean. I mean, I know, but I'm not sure I listen.
The Supreme Court says you have to admit James Meredith. James Meredith wins his legal case, and he's going to be admitted to the University of Mississippi. And so that when I say Patterson loses, Patterson is the chief litigant on, you know, these cases in front of the courts. And so the state of Mississippi and Joe Patterson as the Attorney General lose this case. And James Meredith, the Supreme Court says, must be admitted. The dilemma facing the White South then in 1962 is whether to say, no, we're not going to abide by this at all. And no matter what the Supreme Court says, we will not listen, provoking a showdown with the federal government. Or can we come up with a means of bending but not breaking the segregationist back? And this is where Joe Patterson would fall. Joe Patterson would very clearly say, okay, we've got to do this. We've got to figure out how to do this and to get this guy in. Once James Meredith is enrolled, he would later say, I don't think the University of Mississippi is desegregated at all. Instead, it has one black man who's the most segregated black man in America, which is a lot of truth to that, right? Like what James Meredith went through the couple of years he was at the University of Mississippi just to graduate, it's amazing that he persisted and survived. And so Patterson begins shaping in 1962 the legal acceptance of the Supreme Court's decision to admit Meredith, while also trying to make sure that there's as little progress overall in that regard as possible. And ultimately, the violence that erupts at the University of Mississippi and the white riots on campus over Meredith's arrival is a central part of this debate and this turning point. And what you see is a federal government willing to defend the Supreme Court and Supreme Court decisions and to send federal troops in the state of Mississippi. And that's really a turning point.
Like 500, U.S. Marshals and 12,000 federalized troops are there when he goes home. But before that, Ross Barnett, as governor, hatches a plan to arrest Meredith in Jackson, not letting him register in Oxford, where the university is, but arrest him and have him come to Jackson to register and arrest him on a kind of a cooked up illegitimate charge.
So, I mean, this is a really fascinating part of the story. And, the idea for Ross Barnett is he had just gotten through the state legislature a moral turpitude clause that would impact admissions at our public colleges and universities in the state of Mississippi. And essentially, the moral turpitude clause said anyone convicted of a crime or even arrested was not eligible to attend a university. And they very quickly get this bill passed.
Like overnight.
Overnight, yeah, right in the middle of this crisis. And by demanding that Meredith come to Jackson, where the offices of the Board of Trustees are in Jackson, demanding he come there to register, instead of what every other student does is register on campus at the college that they're attending, demanding that Meredith would come, he's able to get Meredith in absentia convicted of this fraudulent, basically voter fraud charge, get him convicted, and the plan is to arrest him when he comes into the state offices in Jackson, and thereby Barnett has cooked up this legal reason. Patterson says, no, this is bad, and what's going to happen is an even greater crisis facing us in the federal government, and he tells the Kennedy administration. He calls the Kennedy administration and says, hey, Ross Barnett is about to do this. This is not good. And it's his phone call in that moment, and just the decision to do that was not born out of some sympathy for James Meredith. It was not born out of some idea that we'll be a better Mississippi if we desegregate the University of Mississippi. It was Joe Patterson saying, this is going to cause more problems than it helps. This is going to cause more problems for white supremacy, more problems for Jim Crow, and we're going to be in an even bigger problem than we would have been before if this goes through and James Meredith gets arrested. But it's a critical moment where he opposes the Barnett administration, and it's his split with that diehard regime, that line in the sand defiance demagogic regime in that one moment.
And yet the people who opposed his position have evidence there are two dead men as a result of the riots. If I understand correctly what happened, the riots started, there were no local or state authorities to sort of put it down. So the feds came in, fired tear gas. I don't know if they were students or not, but two men were killed as a result. And everybody on the demagogic side basically blamed the feds and the intrusion of the feds. And they blamed Joe Patterson. And they got together and ran somebody against him the next year.
They certainly would. And the irony in this story is it's Ross Barnett is the one who withdraws state police from Oxford, orders the withdrawal of any local authorities from the University of Mississippi campus so that when the white rioters get there, there's no one to oppose them. And it's forcing the hand of the federal government to come in and to put this riot down. And, you know, one of the guys who's killed is a French journalist, Paul Guillard. And so this moment is one where there is big change coming. You're absolutely right. Ross Barnett and his ilk will blame Joe Patterson, even though they are fundamentally the ones who are intentionally creating the situation where the riots can happen, right? But they found their scapegoat in Joe Patterson.
Next time Joe runs, he has strong opposition.
He has strong opposition, and Ross Barnett endorses the candidate running against him, and he wins in a relative landslide. Joe Patterson does, not the opposition, which tells you, I think it informs this narrative by helping us to understand that, you know, despite what the kind of the general view of white Mississippians are in that time, the majority of white voters agreed with Joe Patterson.
That was the point I would make. Joe Patterson won not because they went out and registered tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of black voters.
Oh, this is before the Voting Rights Act, so there aren't black voters.
Exactly.
Right? There's still no black folks voting. This is a white, conservative, segregationist electorate that reelects him in a relative landslide after the Meredith crisis, which is, you know, kind of counterintuitive to what we think of when we think about the power structure in Mississippi. You would have thought that in 1963, a Ross Barnett endorsed candidate in the aftermath of the Meredith crisis would have wiped the floor with Joe Patterson, but he didn't. And Patterson wins, and it marks this moment where really the power structure changes. It changes, and no longer are you going to have these type of explicit demagogic racists in power. It doesn't mean that white supremacy is dead, and it doesn't mean that Joe Patterson isn't espousing a white supremacist mentality and sensibility. He absolutely is, but it's no longer going to be based around racist demagoguery and violence.
The coffee case, that was a case where the power structure, the white power structure, set up private academies and gave publicly funded vouchers to parents so they could afford those schools and basically pull their kids out of the integrated schools. And Joe Patterson had to argue that that was not an effort to circumvent Brown, the Brown decision, which held that, of course, it's separate but equal is not constitutional.
Well, you know, segregationists are really helped after the Brown decision by what we call the Brown 2 decision a year later, where the Supreme Court says desegregation must proceed with all deliberate speed. And, you know, of course, deliberate and speed are opposites. They mean the exact opposite thing. And in Mississippi, that would be 1970. So you're talking 16 years of, quote unquote, deliberate speed. And it's Joe over those 16 years. And of course, Joe Patterson will die in office in 1969, and he won't live to see the actual desegregation of public schools. But in those 16 years, in the 15 years after Brown that he's still alive, it is his job as attorney general to come up with ways, and as he sees it, to appease the federal government, to abide by the Supreme Court's decision in Brown, but, you know, maintain as much white supremacist power as possible. And one of the real central ways that they do this, yes, you have the rise of segregationist academies, you have public funding, building funds, you have the first, when we talk about school vouchers, the first voucher system is to help poor white people be able to afford to attend private segregationist academies in Mississippi. Almost 100% of our private schools in the state of Mississippi were founded as segregationist academies. There's a handful of exceptions. Some of our religious schools, the Episcopal schools, the Catholic schools, we have a historically black boarding school in Mississippi, but 99% of private academies in the state of Mississippi to this day were founded as segregationist institutions. And one of the things Patterson comes up with and helps to craft, he's not really solely responsible for inventing this, is this idea of responding to the Brown decision with a policy that came to be known as freedom of choice. And I think freedom of choice really illustrates this shift in politics and in political rhetoric for segregationists. Because the idea was pretty simple. A parent in a school district will be free to choose where they send their kids to school. Any parent, any color, says nothing about race. You're free to choose if it's the formerly all-white school that has all the best resources, the best science labs, the best athletic facilities, the best libraries, the most books, the best, you know, whatever. You're, as a black parent in that school district, you're free to choose to send your child to that school, which sounds great. The problem was that Joe Patterson realized what black parent was going to be the first to send their kid to a formerly all white school, knowing what the repercussions were going to be. Not very many, but there were a few who did, despite the repercussions, despite violence that they faced and that their kids might face in school, despite economic repercussions like losing their jobs, sometimes losing their housing, being evicted as sharecroppers. There were a handful of Black folks who still made that choice for their kids. And that also helped segregationists, because in the same sense that James Meredith was the most segregated Black man in America, in Joe Patterson's mind, you got two Black kids at a formerly all-white school. They are completely resegregated in that society and in that space. But Joe Patterson can say, and others can say, we got two Black kids who go to this school now. We're desegregated. And none of it rests on language that is explicitly racist. None of it rests on explicit violence and intimidation. And instead, it talks about freedom and choice and the ability to choose whatever, as a parent, you think is the best option for your kids. And it is incredibly effective until the Supreme Court eventually throws out freedom of choice as a plan for desegregation to abide by Brown. But you see in that this shift post-1962 in political rhetoric and language and policy that enables this bend but not break, you know, era of segregationist resistance.
It is interesting the language that the movement fell back on. Freedom was one of the words, freedom of choice. But states' rights was also a phrase that got thrown around a lot. They didn't want the federal government coming in and saying what they had to do, that the state had a right.
And, you know, ostensibly the Civil War had defeated any notions of states' rights in relation to the federal government. You would have thought that would have been put to bed. But states' rights has a long history of rearing its ugly head. And even the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, which Joe Patterson would sit on the board of his entire career, which was a state-funded Gestapo-esque organization created solely to spy on Black Mississippians and civil rights activists and were responsible for some pretty heinous crimes, their founding legislation, right after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, says that they were created to prevent the encroachment of federal power on the state of Mississippi. It was an explicitly states' rights mantra embedded in their founding legislation. And Patterson really is a major supporter of the Sovereignty Commission and how it would work and operate and use this notion of states' rights to, again, oppose Black advancement.
Can we go back to Meredith for a moment? Because after he graduates, leaves Oxford, he goes to New York, gets his law degree at Columbia, I think. And then he wants to have a march. Right, for, was it March Against Fear, he called it?
Fear, that's right.
Yeah.
So he had this idea, and this is after the Voting Rights Act had passed in 1965. He wanted to march from Memphis to Jackson, which is, driving is about 3 hours. He wanted to walk through the state of Mississippi. And the goal was to show Black Mississippians that they had nothing to fear in registering to vote after the Voting Rights Act. He wanted to walk through these towns, and he wanted people to register. Everybody thought this was a crazy idea. No civil rights group, no real well-known activists signed on to this cause and would join this cause. But Meredith, ever the iconoclast, and Meredith was certainly an iconoclast, Meredith moves forward with it. And when you see the pictures of the beginning of his march, he's got like one or two people with him. There's a couple of reporters who are there. And then on day two of his march against fear, a shooter jumps out of the bushes and shoots him in the back with a shotgun and shotgun pellets. Of course, Meredith survives. He's still alive today. But that moment in the march against fear galvanizes civil rights activists and organizations who come to Mississippi and pick up this cause. And it, in 1966, is a turning point in the modern civil rights movement in this country and in this nation. And what you have in particular are Stokely Carmichael and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, they're together marching side by side, but explicitly and openly disagreeing on the future of the movement. And you have Willie Ricks and Stokely Carmichael coining the term Black Power during that march in Greenwood, Mississippi in 1966. And at the same time, you got Martin Luther King on the other hand saying, we're not about Black Power, we're about freedom now. I honestly think Black Power is one of the most misunderstood social movements in American history. And there's a great interview with a civil rights activist named Floyd McKissick. And he is talking about Black Power. And he says, you know, the problem with Black Power is that power in this nation and in this country, historically, white power has always been undergirded by violence. Look through slavery, look through Reconstruction and lynching and Jim Crow. Power was supported by violence. So that when white Americans in particular heard the term Black Power, they felt they were thinking they were talking about Black violence and Black revolution. Now, there was a belief in armed self-defense, which frankly was way more common and acceptable to the vast majority of African Americans in the South than notions of Gandhian nonviolence. The vast majority of activists and Black Southerners and Black Mississippians could use nonviolence as a tactic, but they didn't live nonviolence as a philosophy. You have the great Vernon Dahmer, NAACP activist, who will, you know, in promising to pay the poll taxes for Black Mississippians, will have his house firebombed, and he dies firing back on the Klan as his family escapes the back door. And so this notion of armed self-defense, which is built in the Constitution, kind of comes to the fore. This eschewing of nonviolence, even as a tactic, even if you never espoused it as a lived philosophy, the way Martin Luther King attempted to do, or Gandhi would attempt to do. And so in the Meredith March, there's this incredible tension within the movement. And so not only are you seeing changes and evolution at the same time of segregationist strategies for opposing the movement, you're seeing the movement itself change and evolve at the exact same time in front of your eyes. And some of it is the realization that the attractiveness of Black power is the realization that the likes of Joe Patterson and the term practical segregationists, they're not going to give up power. And instead, what you're going to have to do is build power within Black communities from the ground up, grassroots power that enables Black folks to govern themselves and to have their own leadership locally. Because you're never going to rip it out of the hands of this elite white power structure. You're going to have to build it from the bottom up. And so the Meredith March is this other, from 62 to 66, James Meredith and his role in these incredible changes in the state of Mississippi, it's really remarkable. Arguably, there's no single person more important in this narrative than James Meredith between 62 and 66.
Well, and as you say, Meredith survives, but he also rejoins the march.
At the very end. He sure does. And when that march arrives in Jackson, there's 30,000 people. It's the largest single day civil rights protest in the history of the state of Mississippi. And Meredith is there at the very end to join it downtown Jackson when they reach the steps of the state capitol. And there's this incredible moment of real almost kind of pride and joy and faith that maybe something can change and that these people are going to be able to usher in another new era. But of course, segregationists didn't give up. They didn't just quit and move away. They're going to continue fighting and continue evolving. And this idea of, again, the subtitle, evolving resistance to Black advancement, they're going to keep erecting barriers.
And you talk about that in the book, and I want to go into it a little bit, because we've got the evolving civil rights movement. We've got, in a sense, the shifting kind of pragmatism. And out of that comes an evolving politics as well. And a lot of people attribute it to Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. You don't.
Yeah. And in fact, what I would suggest, you know, Nixon's Southern strategy is also a very old strategy that the Republican Party had been trying to employ at least since Herbert Hoover, who had called it his Lily White strategy. Nixon didn't use the words Lily White. He used, you know, the Southern strategy in many ways, an homage to this change in language. But the idea was the same. The Lily White strategy for Herbert Hoover and the Southern strategy for Nixon was, hey, vote for us as Republicans, and we're going to leave you alone. We're going to let you control your own politics. We know that African Americans left the Republican Party during the New Deal and became Democrats. Why are y'all still voting Democrat? Vote Republican. Join us. And it's Nixon who finally that sea change hits while he is president. But his version of the Southern strategy is informed by the white South. It is the language and the rhetoric of a Joe Patterson. It's not Nixon doesn't invent this idea. Again, it's an idea that had been around a long time, but his version of it is very much informed by watching these changes in places like Mississippi and watching what the likes of Joe Patterson are doing to change the narrative in the state to maintain as much power as possible. So Nixon benefits from it. He certainly uses it, but he doesn't invent it. He's not creating it. And he's certainly being informed deeply by what is going on in the movement. And look, we know that he rides into power in 1968, largely on the disillusionment of white folks in this country with all of the change that's been happening over the course of the 1960s.
Well, in Virginia, coincidentally, there's a guy, Mills Godwin, who's elected as a Democrat, and then Linwood Houlton gets elected as the first Republican since Reconstruction as governor, and Mills Godwin comes back and succeeds Houlton as a Republican, having switched parties.
That's right. And you know, the real success of this shift, of this kind of, at least in name, shift away from the all-white Democratic Party of the South to the Republican Party is, I think, reflected in today's politics and in the power of today's politics and in politicians who can, with a straight face today, look at you and say, these policies that we're implementing, they're not racist. They don't have racist intent. None of the language is racist, but understanding implicitly that they absolutely have racist impacts, racial disparity in the impact of the policies that we're seeing today, especially in this current moment that we're living in. And it's a function of the success of the shift that began in places like Mississippi in the 1960s, away from this old line demagogic conservatism, in racist conservatism, into this new era of political rhetoric and power. Even when fundamentally the inspiration, the source of the motivation is ultimately the same, and it's to maintain as much power within the white community, particularly the white elite community, as possible. But now there are people who look at you with a straight face and say, we're not racist, and they actually believe it. I think a lot of them believe it anyways, and that they think that what they're doing doesn't, on the surface of it, have a racist intent or impact.
Well, we talked about Patterson's argument in the voucher case, but I hear and read a lot about the voucher systems and all the states that are adopting those. And I think there's a Supreme Court case, and the reporters covering it suggested that the court, SCOTUS, might be leaning toward allowing it. I don't know that I see a lot of difference between the voucher system they're talking about invoking now, vis-a-vis the one that he tried to sustain.
They're the same. I mean, the one today is rooted in the exact same philosophy as what was invented in a place like Mississippi in the 1960s. And again, it's on the surface of it, you can say, hey, anybody's got access to this. But in terms of private schools and private academies, who has access to those schools? Who's going to get in? Who's going to be admitted? Like, are poor Black folks from Mississippi going to have the same access to these private schools and the power that comes along with being admitted and being able to afford to attend these private schools? The intent is the same, and it is no doubt this modern push to return to this voucher system is absolutely informed and directly descended from that of the 1960s.
I don't see how it could be not anything other than directly descended. I mean, it parallels the so-called freedom of choice system as well.
Sure does. It absolutely does. And, you know, in the 60s, it went along with a voucher system that paid Black Southerners to leave the South for higher education rather than attempting to desegregate some of our schools. So if you were Black in Mississippi and want to go to med school, the state of Mississippi would pay for you to leave the state rather than desegregate the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And so it went hand in hand with that type of policy. Again, policies that on the surface don't say anything really about race. We'll pay for you. We'll give you vouchers to attend the school of your choice, even though it was also discriminatory in the sense that in terms of the college voucher system to pay Black students to leave the state, those grants were reimbursable, meaning that you had to pay your tuition up front and get reimbursed. And they would only pay you as much as what it would cost to attend the in-state institution. So if it was more expensive for you to attend Howard Medical School or Meharry in Tennessee, if it was more expensive for you to go there, you had to come up with the difference. They did not cover what those overages might have been. But the intent between that system and certainly today's voucher system, it is the same. And it is an effort to maintain, again, as much power as possible.
Well, and you use the word maintain power by elites. I'm wondering, how much would you ascribe this effort to racial motivations and how much to a caste system and maintaining a caste system? And is there really a difference?
Well, look, in a place like Mississippi, I don't think you can separate race and racial distinctions, because you're talking about a state that has the highest population of African Americans of any state in the nation, and essentially always has. After the Civil War, there were two states that had majority Black populations, Mississippi and South Carolina. And again, to this day, these are the two places that have the highest percentage of African Americans. And so I don't think in a place like Mississippi that you can separate race from this story. Of course, all of these things in academia, we love this term intersectionality. There is real intersectionality between all of these things and all of these forces that are happening. And so even when we look at a theory like critical race theory, that is attempting to help us connect and understand that intersectionality of those forces in society. You know, so is there a caste system? I do believe so. And of course, Isabel Wilkerson wrote this book, Caste. I think there's some problems with Wilkerson's book and her conceptualization, but there certainly is a lot that's right to it. And so I would say there's overlap, but I don't think that in Mississippi or in America that you can subtract race from that story, from that narrative. Just don't think it's possible because it has been so powerful for so long and informed so much of our history. And it's not that long ago, right? What we're talking about. Talk about Medgar Evers being assassinated in 1963. Merle Evers is still alive. His widow, right? His daughter, Rena Evers, who was in the home the night her father is murdered, is alive and well and lives here in Jackson, Mississippi. You know, this history is not ancient history that we're talking about. It absolutely still informs us and informs who and where we are. And if you look at even modern news stories in a place like Mississippi, the recent one in the last year, the Goon Squad, as they called themselves in Rankin County, which is a rural conservative county just south of Jackson, where these white police officers over years inflicted violence and oppression on Black communities and African Americans. And it was absolutely a racialized story. And so this is still around. Race does still impact us. Is there a caste system? I think you can argue very well that there is, but I don't think you can subtract race from that story, especially in Mississippi.
Well, I think maybe even on a national level, I would submit that the caste system is based on race, or that race is built into the caste system. I know that about 25 years ago or so, there was a big international press conference. Bill Clinton was participating in it, where they talked about an international genetics study that had discovered that there was no biological difference between the races, that they were all the same. I don't know if you picked up on that at the time. That doesn't seem to have changed anything. In other words, they had this big, you know, half dozen different international political leaders all gathered around and big press conference, and it got a lot of coverage. But I don't see that anything changed as a result.
No, it really hasn't. And when I talk about benefit to the white elite, certainly there's a class element within that. But, you know, something that scholars and other observers have talked about for a long time is how particularly poor white Southerners were willing to vote against their own self-interest in the name of solidarity with whiteness. And that no doubt continues to this day. You know, Mississippi is the poorest state in the nation, and African Americans represent the poorest demographic of any population in the nation in the state of Mississippi. Black Mississippians are the poorest Americans. But we got plenty of poverty within the white community too. And so this power structure has always benefited an elite within white society, or rarely the poor lower end elements. And yet whiteness has become a driving factor over the last 150 years in how people think about their leaders and how they vote and who they put into positions of power. And it overrides just about all other considerations.
Well, given that science discovery was much discussed and it didn't change things, how do we change the scenery? How do we change the topic, the debate, the focus? How do we broaden the discussion?
First of all, we got to be honest and we got to talk about it. And in terms of my own work in Mississippi and as a tenured historian at a public institution, I think it's my responsibility to tell the truth and to do programs like this and talk about this history in open and honest ways. And ultimately, I argue all the time, I believe the number one civil rights issue of our day is equitable access to highest quality education possible for all children. If we can create an educational system in this country where everybody has access to the best education possible, we can change a lot of things. And I think that's ultimately, fundamentally where it starts. It starts in education and how we teach, what we teach, and what we talk about, which makes this current moment that we're in particularly dangerous, where they are trying to very much a power system in this current administration that's trying to curtail what we can and cannot talk about. Of course, I wrote this book about segregationists and about Joe Patterson. My real work is around the history of the civil rights movement in Mississippi. And so I do quite a bit around activism and activists. And I run a space at Jackson State, the COFO Center, COFO, the Council of Federated Organizations, that served as the state headquarters for Freedom Summer. It's this powerful emotional space to be in. It's really a beautiful place. But I talk about all the time that the people who walked through those doors 60 years ago are some of the greatest American heroes in history, heroic in the sense that they believed in this nation, they believed in democracy, they believed that all people, meaning all human beings, were created equal, and demanded that this nation try to live up to those ideals, and demanded that they be able to exercise their rights as American citizens. These are great people. We must be able to talk about Medgar Evers, World War II veteran who fights fascism and Nazism and comes back home to face Jim Crowism, tries to vote wearing his World War II uniform with his brother in his World War II uniform and gets turned away by a white mob, who's assassinated in his driveway because he demanded the rights of American citizenship. But if we erase the oppression, the reality of the story of white supremacy, if we're not allowed to talk about the things that motivated Medgar Evers and Fannie Lou Hamer and Ida B. Wells before them, if we erase that, then they're not heroic. What they were just, you know, people making a lot of noise, right? If we can't tell the whole story, if we can't tell the truth about this past, if we can't analyze Joe Patterson and what they were trying to do to maintain power, if we can't be honest, then we are going to whitewash this history and we're going to really set ourselves way back. And so we must demand being able to tell the full story and to be able to be allowed to analyze and to engage in an intellectual endeavor that helps us understand who we are as a nation and where we have been and where we are today.
But just like in Joe Patterson's day, not everyone's going to accept it. All we can hope for is a majority.
Oh, that's exactly right. And I also say to people all the time, people say, well, what do you do with these people who obviously are never going to change? I'm like, nothing, because I can't do anything about them. All I can do is continue the work I do, work with the students I work with, work with the community that I'm embedded in Jackson, and at Jackson State, and to do my job as a tenured full professor of history at Jackson State, marshaling evidence and honest evidence to analyze and understand our past so that it informs our present. But no, we're not going to save everybody. We're just not going to.
What people do with information is never up to those of us who give them the information.
That's right. But we've got to have the capacity and the freedom to do that. And honestly, isn't that why tenure was created at colleges and universities? For that very purpose, especially in the midst of the Red Scare, right? To speak truth to power and to offer thoughtful, analyzed, intellectual arguments about who we are as a people in whatever field it is that we're studying.
Well, we will leave it there for the moment anyway. Thank you very much, Robbie. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Bill. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback helps others find the show. Be sure to follow us on social media and check out our website at upstartcrow.org for more information on our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.